a man with fishy lips and bad teeth, and the placid, cow-like eyes of a born swindler. This man was Farquhar's butler, and William paused and took his measure and then pushed past. The house, palatial and dazzling by gaslight, in the day appeared cold and marbled and forbidding, the polished white columns of the stairwell shining with their own luminescence. Farquhar rose from his antique desk and came to meet them, immaculate in a black, high-cut suit, a green vest, his slender face both anxious and haughty. "Well, sir, and what does Scotland Yard propose to do?" He did not extend his hand. "Mr. Farquhar, sir, you remember Mr. Pinkerton?" "Of course. Your entertainment on Saturday left quite an impression on my wife, sir. On her and me both." The study was long, narrow, with deep cherry-wood panels in the ceiling and a lacquered oak mantel over the fireplace that gleamed like oil. It looked, to William's eye, strange and beautiful and exotic. "You admire it, sir," Farquhar said, catching his gaze. "It is a menorah out of Russia, a Jewish ritual object. Lovely, is it not? I mean to display it downstairs in the great hall. It is very rare." "The rabbis don't mind you having it?" William asked. Farquhar smiled gravely as if at a witticism. He said, "My wife is unwell, sir, or she should be here to welcome you herself. I have been urging her to travel to her house in Yorkshire. Half the household has already been sent on ahead. I cannot think what keeps her here. Perhaps when she is feeling more herself, sir." "Perhaps. This affair has upset her, sir. Have you seen the newspapers, Mr. Shaw? Have you seen what they write about me?" "You mustn't mind the gossips, sir." "They claim I am involved, man. They say I have orchestrated this entire affair. Why? Why, to drum up publicity." William grunted. He took off his hat and laid it on the desk, and he sat wearily in one of the armchairs. Propriety be damned. He said, "Mr. Shaw tells me you don't want to prosecute the thief." "Thieves," corrected Shaw. "Be assured, this will prove a crew." Farquhar shook his head. "I care little for their situation. It is the Emma that concerns me. I would like it returned, Mr. Pinkerton, and I should not care to find my £10,000 taken without being assured of such an outcome." Shaw was still standing, uneasy, and only now, when Farquhar returned to his desk and sat, did the chief, too, take a seat. "It is my job to ensure that does not happen, sir," he said. "It was your job, sir, to prevent such misfortune from happening at all. Are the streets not safe any more? I am frankly amazed you would come to our city, Mr. Pinkerton, riddled as it is with such crime. You must think us all barbarians." "It's never the city, Mr. Farquhar. It's always the people." "The city, sir, makes the people." Shaw cleared his throat, withdrew a small notebook and pencil. "If you'd care to tell us what you've heard, sir. Did you say 10,000? Am I to understand the thieves have been in touch?" Farquhar nodded gravely. "They demand £10,000, divided equally between notes and open bonds, sir." "Yes. A letter was delivered to me this morning from their solicitor." He carefully shifted the silver menorah to one side of the desk, and then he gave Shaw a hard look. "Is it not rather strange, sir, that they should retain legal representation? Does it not make them vulnerable?" "Vulnerable? Why, could you not find them through this man? This..." Farquhar rose abruptly, crossed the room, snatched a sheet of paper from a cigar table and scanned it. "This Gabriel Utterson?"
"Utterson," William muttered.
Shaw gave him a quick look.
"Gabriel Utterson's somewhat notorious, Mr. Farquhar. A clever fellow. Not an ethical bone in his body. The problem, sir, is that his actions here are perfectly legal. Everyone is entitled to legal counsel, and unless you agree to press charges, there is no legal ground for the Yard to get involved."
"Mr. Pinkerton," Farquhar said, hooking a thumb into his waistcoat pocket and turning one foot out and cocking his knee, "at the recommendation of one of my oldest friends, Mr. Busby, I have decided I would like to hire you, sir. I understand your terms are rather..."
"Henry Busby," William interrupted.
"Our results for him were less than satisfactory. He was most impressed by your methods, sir."
William did not know what the gallerist might know of the Busby blackmail letters, but it could not be much. Henry Busby had been blackmailed for lewd sexual acts, and in the end, every evidence turned up by the Pinkerton operatives suggested that the man, wealthy, unmarried, eccentric, had been blackmailing himself. The case had been abandoned. Farquhar steepled his fingers before him. "Shall we discuss the matter of payment, sir?"
$50 a day, plus expenses, William said at once. It's standard and non-negotiable. In this matter it should prove modest enough. We'll complete the paperwork at a later date.
You accept then, sir?
I must remind you the Pinkertons are not police, Mr. Farquhar, said Shaw. Farquhar gave the chief a withering look.
Let me be clear. I wish to hire Mr. Pinkerton to ensure the safe return of the Emma. I do not wish to prosecute the men responsible. I have no interest in revenge.
William grimaced. Maybe you should.
I beg your pardon.
You give these men what they want. It makes you a more attractive target. For the next time.
Tomorrow shall be the last time, Farquhar said gravely. This will not happen again.
Tomorrow. The letter stipulated tomorrow, sir.
Shaw rubbed at his whiskers. That is rather immediate.
Farquhar passed across the letter from Utterson, and the chief inspector scanned its contents.
These are unusually organized thieves, Shaw said. One typically waits weeks or even months to hear from them. I wonder at the speed of this.
He glanced up. You will need to act quickly to collect the ransom, sir. I would suggest you do not attend to your bank alone. I can send a man with you.
William took the letter from Shaw.
So you don't yet know where the exchange will take place. Is that correct?
It is indeed, sir. The solicitor will send the details tomorrow morning. I am to wait for them here.
Shaw nodded. As soon as you hear, come by the yard. We shall establish our final details then.
How is this to work, gentlemen?
The gallerist said uneasily.
It's simple, William said. You do what they ask. You take the money to them where they ask for it. Hand it over. The thieves will then deliver the painting to you. It's all on their terms.
And I am expected to just trust them, sir? To have faith in their honesty that they will present me with the Emma?
William gave the man a long, level look.
Yes, he said. You are.
43. Martin Reckitt lay with his face white against the earth, and in the moonlight, Fool sat staring at it, bereft. He ate the salt crackers slowly. Something had broken in him and would not be repaired. For 10 years he had dreamed of Charlotte, carried her daguerreotype, weighed her in his heart, and found her measure, and all that time he had been wrong. He had not known her in the least. At last he rose and slid on his heels down a low, wet slope of grass to a stand of oaks at the bottom, and he huddled against a fallen tree. But he did not sleep. He could not shake the eerie feeling that he was not alone. At dawn he rose and studied the sky, and then retraced his steps and stood over the cold corpse, and stared at it again. And then he took from the dead man's pockets a billfold Charlotte had given him, and he left that place forever. It was 4 miles into the town of Midhurst through wet fields, and he waited in the local square with his shoes sopping for the post office to open, and he followed the clerk inside and purchased a ticket home. He did not care that his actions must look suspicious. The London and South Western punched through Midhurst at 10:15 every day, and Fool, the lone passenger on the platform, climbed wearily aboard, and the ticket agent hollered the all clear, and the engine huffed and steamed back up to speed. He rode the line through to Waterloo Station, and so returned to London, silent, dark, alone. He said nothing of the killing to Flood or Molly. As he came up through the mustard-brown fog at Penton Place, Flood opened the door and stood glaring. The house Mrs. Sykes had located for them looked cold, its owners gone for the season, the neighbours down on their luck and unlikely to take an interest. The street had been fashionable once, or at the least had been wealthy, but that age was long past, and in the fog the houses looked now cold, soot-stained and desolate.
"You look like you slept in the open," Flood grunted, "or failed to. Is there a twig in your hair?"
slamming the door and locking it behind them. Fool stripped off his frock coat, damp yet at the collar and wrists, and looked about, and then hung it on the hat stand in the corner.
"I could use a bite," he said.
"What do we have?"
"What do we have what's warm? Nothing but a bit of porridge."
Flood stepped back, ran his knuckles through his beard.
"We never known if you was coming back alone, Mr. Edom."
Fool blew out his cheeks.
"As you can see," he said.
"Everything go all right, then?"
He shrugged, not wanting to talk about it.
"Tell me how we fare," he said instead.
"Is the cart hired?
Have we heard from Gabriel?"
"Go on. Where's the flit, then?"
Molly announced, coming out from the parlour. She was wearing boots laced with mud and tracking prints across the carpet. She paused when she saw Fool's expression.
"Charlotte ain't come back," Flood said. "It's like Mr. Edom told us."
"Done what you set out to, is it? Martin Reckitt's clear of the clink?"
"Something like that." But the child seemed to sense his distress, and gave him a strange look, and this in itself, this gentleness, made Fool suddenly fierce. He thought of Charlotte's face in the firelight the night before. She had not betrayed him, perhaps, but neither had she been forthright. He thought of her, standing with him that night on Blackfriars. She had tried to warn him that her ends were not his to know, but he had not wanted to hear it. He looked up and saw Flood and Molly, pity in their eyes. He scowled.
"We have much to do. Where is my trunk?
You did not leave it at Half Moon Street."
Flood gestured to the stairs.
"I never trusted her, Adam," said Molly. "I never did."
"It doesn't matter."
"And if she comes back here?" said Flood.
"She won't."
"But if she do?"
"We won't see her again,"
Fool said angrily. He had brooded over what had happened with Charlotte all the long grey train journey back into London. The worst was that he had not seen it coming. He had understood she was different from how she had been, and he had recognized something, some trace or hint or warning in her, but he had failed to realize its import. She had murdered her uncle out of a vengeance that Fool, too, could understand. Had killed him and walked away from it, and who was he to condemn her for it? He thought of Alan Pinkerton and felt a great black ache in his heart. He left Flood and Molly below and climbed the stairs tiredly and entered a small bedroom at the top of the house. And there was a ladder standing down through the ceiling, and this he climbed into the attic. A small narrow bed, Fool's travelling case standing open upon it, a green trunk with clothes in disarray, papers and dossiers stacked against one wall. A porcelain washstand stood in a corner with a towel folded over it, and Fool washed the mud and road grease from his face and hands, and he washed the back of his neck and dried himself with a towel, and when he turned around he saw Flood standing at the ladder.
"What is it?"
he said, less kindly than he meant it. He had some idea of the run of the giant's thinking, and he did not think he would like it. But it was not about Charlotte Reckitt.
"Your bloody Molly,"
Flood said instead.
"Guess who rode the bloody carriage into a worksite off Lambeth Road yesterday and knocked over a ladder holding a sheet of iron so the whole bloody slice of it come down on me like an X. Cleave the damned horse in two, it did. Nearly took off me own bleeding head."
"It weren't that bad,"
Molly's voice piped up from below.
"Me arse it weren't."
Fool stared hard at Flood filling the trapdoor. What he wanted was to rest.
"Must we discuss this now? Can it not wait?"
But then Molly was shrugging her way up the ladder and poked her head through and said, half grinning,
"There were a blooming rat the size of a ham climbing my leg. What would you do?"
Fool laid himself down on the cot, still dressed. He folded a hand over his eyes.
"What are you saying?"
he said slowly.
"Our horse is dead."
"The beast you hired?"
"Aye."
He raised his head.
"Do we have another?"
Flood looked at Molly. She studied with great interest a grease mark on the wall.
"Find us one,"
Fool said, "before tomorrow."
"Aye."
"Molly," he said,
"you go see Mr. Appleby Barr. Tell him we'll have some business to clear with him tomorrow afternoon. I think he's been patient enough."
He rubbed at his eyes with the back of his wrist, and then he said,
Japheth? Wait. On second thought, hire us a new wagon, too. Something clearly marked. Noticeable. A labourer's cart. Wasn't there an outfit outside Waterloo Station, the Flash used to frequent?
Old Monkey Abbott's, Flood said. Aye, I know the place.
But Fool did not rest. In the afternoon, he stripped down to his shirt sleeves and went into the scullery at the back of the house and heated a pot of water, and went to the kitchen and stoked the fire there until it reached a high blaze. The heat was ferocious. He unwrapped the wax impressions of the gallerist's keys from the strips of oilskin where he had kept them. There were 7 impressions in total. He was cautious, and he poured and cooled and heated again what was needed, using the strange, contained furnace that he had erected. He was alone in the house, with Flood seeing to their transport, and Molly arranging a meeting with Appleby Barr for the following day, and he would pause often and stoke the fire, and listen to the house over its roar. Then he would wipe at his brow and again tug on the heavy, fireproof mitts, and fumble with the astrolabe of molten metal. He did not finish until late into the evening, and when he looked up, he saw Molly in the doorway, hands on her forehead and sweat cooling on her throat, and he did not know how long she had been there. A rawness was in him that had nothing to do with the next day's events. "Is he prepared, then?" he said at last. "Mr. Barr will see us." "Aye, good. And the pictures all safe and swaddled like a babe in a basket?" Fool nodded, exhausted. "Gabriel sent a message. Farquhar knows what we want. All's in place. Or will be." Molly nodded at the elaborate alchemical apparatus set up behind him. "And you?" she said. "You and Jappy all set then for your part?"
"I guess so."
"How do you aim to manage it while I'm on the river?" Fool lifted his eyebrows.
"Manage what?"
he said innocently. Molly smiled. 44. Then it was Friday. William woke early and washed his chest and arms in cold water, and the water foamed black with soot. He dressed in the darkness and stood at his window, smoking, with his hands clasped behind him. In the street below, a ship-ribbed horse trotted ghost-like through the emptiness, without handler or rein, and vanished like an omen into the mists. William watched the hole in the fog where it had gone close slowly over. After a minute, a crossing sweeper emerged and worked his slow way across the sets. Then 2 clerks hurried past. The fog thinned. It was the day of the exchange. At 8 o'clock he slung his Chesterfield over one arm and set his silk hat on his head and went down through the lobby to the cab stand on the corner. He had eaten no breakfast and was not hungry. He caught a hansom to Scotland Yard, feeling a stillness coming over him, and it was a thing he had felt before, and he knew by this that something that day would go wrong. The yard felt drab, somber, miserable in its greyness. He nodded to the desk sergeant and flexed his wrists to get the blood moving, and signed his name with stiff fingers. At Shaw's office he stopped, and glanced uneasily down the passage, and started to knock, but then just turned the handle and went in.
"You're late," Shaw said with a grunt,
pushing with both palms on the desk, lumbering to his feet, a plate of cold chicken at his elbow. The drapes drawn wide, the pane beaded with condensation. William took off his hat, ran his fingers through his hair to smooth it.
"Where's Farquhar? I'll want to go over the details."
Shaw shrugged. "Blackwell's with him at Gilly's across the way. I'll take you down. You ready for this?"
"Is he?"
"George Farquhar will prove tougher than you suppose." Shaw took a key from his pocket and unlocked the bottom drawer of his desk, and withdrew a revolver and a box of ammunition. He said, "Blackwell did a fine job on that tavern killer. You and Blackwell both. I signed the report on the matter yesterday morning. My superiors are pleased." He unclicked the cartridge from the weapon and loaded it, and replaced it, and then he slid the revolver across his desk.
"The poor girl,"
he said as he worked, meeting William's eye. 30 years, and I'm still surprised how a case can turn out."
"I'm sure that's true."
"You joke, but I'm not ashamed to say it."
"I'm sure that's true, too."
He nodded at the weapon.
"What's that for?"
"For you. For protection."
William withdrew his own loaded Colt from his coat pocket and cradled it in his open palm for Shaw to see, and the chief inspector grinned a quick, wolfish grin around the stem of his pipe.
"William bloody Pinkerton," he said, shaking his head. "London just isn't safe with you in it. Or out of it."
Shaw paused. "There's something else. Martin Reckitt was found murdered yesterday."
"Murdered? Aye."
William could feel the blood slow in him, and he opened and closed his hands, and after a moment he shook his head.
"How? Botched escape, maybe? An argument? Doesn't much matter. The bastard was being transported out to the hulks in Portsmouth and disappeared during a miscount. Seems all of the other prisoners were accounted for."
Shaw gave him a gruff frown. "Farmer from Hayshot brought the body up out of the woods in a barrow cart. Throat was cut. There was a woman from out of town sighted at the pub where the miscount took place." Shaw passed across a telegram to William, and William looked at the description there, and then he looked up.
"It's Charlotte Reckitt," he said in surprise.
"Aye. Explain that one to me." William sat in his heavy Chesterfield, with mud dried to a crust on the front, and he stared at his hat and set it on his knee.
"I have no fucking idea," he said softly. "You think she's been murdered too?"
"I think she was a part of it, killing her uncle."
"Aye. She's not a killer. I know killers. Anyone can kill, William. It just takes the right circumstance."
He knew this was true, but it was not his meaning, and he said nothing, and then he got to his feet. Farquhar would be waiting. He set his hat low on his head. Shaw paused with one arm in the sleeve of his frock coat.
"Thing of it is, London's not like other cities," he said. "Not even like your New York. It's not a matter of us and them. Young ones like Mr. Blackwell don't understand that. Crime is how this city works. Some folk steal to stay alive. Other folk find employment replacing what gets stolen. Others sell the stolen goods back out, and all this keeps the little folk alive. I know it. I was a part of it. I grew up in it."
Shaw held William's eye. "But Reckitt wanted to burn all that. He had a black heart, that one. He was a crook through and through."
"Reckitt said the same about you."
"They always do," Shaw said with a tired smile. Shaw led him down and outside into the dissipating mist of Great Scotland Yard Street, and he ducked around the slow-moving carts and crossed the street and entered a narrow wooden doorway under a red awning. Gillies was a small dining house with private rooms in the back. Shaw passed through a curtain and along a stone-flagged passage, and at the third door he paused.
"You know, negotiations like this don't usually much trouble me," he said. "Seems a rather civilized way to work a thing of value back to its owner. But this Edward Shades is like to do one thing as another when he sees you."
"You be careful."
"I always am."
"The hell you are. I've assigned Mr. Blackwell to assist. He'll stay back and out of sight, of course. But I'll not send you and Mr. Farquhar in without protection. These aren't amateurs."
"If it was bloodshed she'd wanted, he'd be doing this differently, John."
Shaw gave him a long, pitying look, as if he had spoken foolishly, and then opened the door. Blackwell was seated at a table in his shirt sleeves. George Farquhar paced at the window, smoking a cigar. He was dressed in a fine winter coat and a grey hat, and his eyes were ringed in shadow. He smoked fast, fidgeted. Gripped in his left hand was a black leather satchel with silver buckles.
"Gentlemen," William said, "are we prepared?"
Blackwell rose and cleared his throat.
"Mr. Shaw, sir. Mr. Pinkerton."
"A damned nuisance, this," said Farquhar.
His voice came creaking and bent. William wrestled out of his Chesterfield and laid it across a chair, and crossed to the sidebar and poured out four glasses of sherry.
"Sit," he said. "We have much to discuss."
Farquhar peered at William with a questioning look, but came to the table and stubbed out his cigar and sat. William gestured at the satchel.
"Is that the fee?"
"It is.
May I see it?"
Farquhar reluctantly passed the satchel across.
"It is all there, sir, I assure you."
He looked up and regarded the gallerist, and then opened it. Stacks of bills, untraceable bonds. He proceeded to count them. When he was satisfied that the entire £10,000 was present, he looked at Blackwell, and he looked at the gallerist, and he sighed, and said, "Have you ever been in a situation like this before?"
"Why?
Is there a problem with the amount?" William passed the satchel back. "The amount's fine," he said. "The difficult thing is keeping your head and understanding what this morning's about. It's about not having control. You don't get to ask the questions."
"Mr. Farquhar, sir."
Shaw folded his red hands on the table before him. "What Mr. Pinkerton means is that he's done these sorts of transactions dozens of times. You will have to trust him. Now, there's no need to be anxious. You'll have Mr. Blackwell in plain clothes nearby at all times to ensure your safety. But exchanges like this are always tense. One doesn't want to give anyone cause to cut out early."
"Forgive me,"
said Farquhar gravely, "but I should not want them to see a police inspector and believe I had betrayed them."
"It's standard procedure, sir. They'll be expecting it."
"And they won't see me, sir," Blackwell added, "unless they give cause to." Farquhar glanced at William. "Is it all right, sir, in your opinion?" William frowned. "Everyone wants the same thing here, including the thieves."
"You mean the safe return of the Emma, sir?"
"Yes."
"And not the apprehension of the criminals?"
William paused. "That's right."
Shaw gave him a look. "I trust that's the truth, William."
A cold February light was filtering in through the window, dust adrift in its slant. William folded his fists on the table before him. The low daylight was reflecting in the blacks of Shaw's eyes, giving him a sinister look.
"The truth," he said quietly.
"Yes." Blackwell cleared his throat.
"Then shall we begin, gentlemen?"
45. He was still fixing his collar when Molly came to him in his study, working an unpeeled orange in her hand. She sat with a frown.
"Gabriel sent a runner," she said. "Says he'll be in place at 11 o'clock.
Fool withdrew an oblong oak box from the bottom drawer of his writing desk and began to sift through various delicate disguises. At last he found a matted grey moustache and some thorny eyebrows, and he unstoppered a bottle of paste.
"The liner don't depart Liverpool for 6 more days, she said. "I were thinking maybe Devon be a fine quiet spot to lie low in."
"No, Liverpool. Then we won't have to travel by rail and risk being sighted." She unscrewed a tube of paste, sniffed at it, wrinkled her nose. Fool had removed a wrinkled plaster mask and was softening its surface with a horsehair brush dipped in castor oil. "I sent Japheth to make arrangements and return with the cart. We'll watch until you go down. You know which pier?"
"Aye, Billingsgate Stairs."
Peeling back the orange with her thumbnail in a long single corkscrew peel, holding it under her nose.
"You're certain old Farquhar don't mean to cork it up?"
"I'm certain."
"And if he don't come along?"
"He'd be a fool if he did. And George Farquhar is no fool. Expect the pier to be crawling with peelers." He curled the edges of the mask, the empty eye sockets, the mouth drooping in horror. Then he laid the empty mask down on the oilcloth and kneaded it as if it were dough. "The exchange will take place downriver," he went on. "Wait 30 minutes after the payment and then return. Be sure Gabriel counts the money twice. He should know to take his time. He's done this before. I expect there shouldn't be any complications, but..."
"Oh, no. Don't trust Utterson."
"Trust," Fool said, and made a face. "It's not Gabriel I'm worried about. He's been paid well enough. How well can you swim?"
"No better now than last you asked. Unless floating counts."
Fool smiled. "At the first sign of trouble, I want you over the railing and floating as fast as you can for sure." Molly split the orange, slid a quadrant into her mouth.
"What about you?"
she said, chewing. "Japheth and I will use the time to our advantage." She grinned.
"Fine advantage.
Remember your real purpose in this, Molly."
"Oh, I'll keep the old bugger occupied. I heard his wife was so distraught she up and ran off to the countryside.
To her estate there? Yes. She furrowed her brow, chewed and chewed. What is it? She grunted.
Pinkerton won't give us no grief.
Fool tilted his chin back and pressed the plaster to his skin with his eyelids crushed shut, and he worked his fingers around his hairline and under his jaw and smoothed it into place. It felt cool, like a damp towel. He said, muffled,
William Pinkerton will be eager to hear how the morning pans out, I'm certain.
He never played the short game in his life. He'll want this exchange to proceed. If it doesn't, he'll believe his chances of tracking us will be much slimmer.
Them Peeler's going to get a good long look at Gabriel.
With his eyes still shut, his face still tilted back.
And at you. Pinkerton's already done that.
Fool cracked an eyelid.
Gabriel's doing nothing illegal. There's no law against private transactions. It matters not at all if he seemed to be party to this. And you're just some poor, miserable creature, hired off the street.
He began to apply the mustache and eyebrows, the plaster crackling but not splitting. He ran a hand lightly along the sags and wrinkles around his eyes.
How do I look?
Molly looked at him, all at once serious.
You'll be careful, Adam. I always am.
Fool studied his reflection in the mirror for a moment, feeling the old thrill he always felt to see a stranger's face staring back.
As for Mr. Farquhar,
we leave him on the river, honour.
You leave him on the river?
Yes.
It wouldn't do to be followed. Fool unscrewed a jar of powder and dipped a moist finger into the makeup and rubbed it into the new skin.
Adam,
she said. He held her gaze in the mirror.
Oh, we're real sorry about your Charlotte. It not working out and all.
My Charlotte.
He looked down at his hands. He did not know how much the child suspected, but he knew she was no fool.
As it turns out, he said, she was never mine after all.
46. William gripped Farquhar's satchel to his chest. The streets were raucous, street sellers pouring north from London Bridge, touts running along behind the omnibuses, hollering their fares hoarse. Farquhar carried kidskin gloves, crumpled in one fist, and the sharpened bones of his wrists stuck out from his coat sleeves. They had climbed down from the police brougham at the bottom of Threadneedle Street, as instructed, and William led Farquhar by the shoulder across the crowded thoroughfare in the light fog, breathing in the yellow sulphur and the putrid smell of the garbage, and watching the tired horses stumble past. He stood under the statue of Cornwallis, glaring. He saw no sign of shade. A small urchin in an outsized red cap and a grimy face appeared before them, biting at its nails.
"Spare a copper, mister?"
"Off with you," Farquhar barked. William paused. The creature was looking him up and down with interest.
"You wasn't supposed to come,"
it said. Then it turned to the gallerist.
"You'd be Mr. Farter, I expect."
"I beg your pardon." The creature gave an exasperated look.
"Well, come on. You don't get nothing for lolling about. Leave the ape here."
When the gallerist did not move, William said, "I expect this is Mr. Shade's accomplice. We'll need to go with her." Farquhar studied the creature in disgust.
"This?
What was you expecting, the bloody queen?"
"All right," said William, stepping forward. "Lead on." But the urchin only scowled.
"My instructions was to bring this one alone."
Nobody moved. For a long moment, the creature stared at William as if considering, and then shrugged and started off. They were led down towards the river through a maze of mews and stables and back alleys until they came to a roiling mass of passengers and clerks, all pressed in a crush towards a high stone wharf. William saw over the heads of the crowd a sign for the London Bridge steam wharf, and he kept close to Farquhar, and turned his shoulder and began to muscle his way forward. The crowd parted like the sea. Then they were squeezing into a covered passage, plastered with advertisements for Collins Wonder Soap and McMullen's Hair Tonic, and the Star Brothers Magic Portraits off Coombs Court. The density of the crowd and the noise would all work to Shade's advantage, William knew.
"Where's your master?" he demanded. "Is he meeting us here?"
but the urchin ignored him. They descended a set of rickety wooden stairs, so steep William felt his heels almost give out on him, and he had to turn his feet sideways to keep upright. At the small wooden floating dock in the shadow of the bridge, the Thames looked black and foamy and cold. There were wooden booths with great signs stating, "Pay here," and men shouting for customers, but the urchin ducked aside and started walking fast under the bridge on a narrow wooden boardwalk. The span arched high overhead, birds arcing and vanishing in the cathedral-like gloom. Empty steamer ferries were shooting the high waters between the pillars near enough for a man to jump aboard, and the weak daylight filtered down through the stone arches like drifting smoke, and it seemed all at once a different city, a different time. The urchin led them on to a ramshackle dock filled with barkers shouting out destinations and lines of clerks waiting for the passenger ferries. It was Billingsgate Stairs. Shade was nowhere in sight. In the foam and frenzy of steamers pulling into their slips and casting off, there was a solitary hired steamer with a red hull, and a squat captain in a frock coat standing at its cabled railing watching them. The deck lifted, fell, in the swells. William could very clearly read the vessel's name, Goliath, whited out at the waterline. And then he understood. The exchange would take place on the river.
"The river?" Farquhar said, slowing. "We are to travel the river. What's wrong with the river?"
Farquhar met William's gaze.
"I was on the Cricket when it exploded at the Adelphi, sir. I have not taken passage on a steamer since." "The Cricket what blowed up?"
the urchin said. It gave the gallerist a queer grin, ran a knuckle under its nose.
"You ain't going to like today, then?"
William caught the creature's arm.
"I know you," he said. "How do I know you?"
It shook itself free. But all at once he recognized her. It was the girl he had accosted outside Fool's Emporium in Piccadilly. He must have betrayed something in his face, for the girl met his eye boldly. She bared her teeth.
"I know you too, Mr. Pinkerton," she said, unsmiling.
They cast off and moved swiftly out into the current and downriver. There weren't many other ships on the river, dark barges drifting cautiously through the fog. They steered clear of most, and the captain did not speak other than to grunt some greeting to the urchin, but neither did the captain take his eyes off William as they went. He was a bullish man with peat brown whiskers and an enormous black silk hat perched crazily on his head, and he seemed to William a man for hire, and not a part of Shade's retinue. William had his Colt in his pocket and the heavy satchel under his left arm, and he wondered that he had not been searched for weapons. At last the steamer slowed and the captain hove to and held his wheel fast, and the strong pull of the Thames turned their bow slowly, and then William saw, through the mist, the second boat approaching. It was a steam-powered launch, not unlike their hired steamer, but with a tapered bow and a green hull. The figure standing at its railing, with his hands crossed behind his back, was dressed in a long fur-lined greatcoat open to the wind, and underneath he wore a white suit and a white hat, like some madman out of the tropics, and not at all fit for the cold London weather. No one spoke. William glanced across at the child, but she was peering across the deep waters, the fog tendrilling there low and thin and fast. Farquhar stiffened at his elbow.
"Is that him? Is that the man I am to meet?"
William watched, but said nothing.
"You two," the urchin barked. "You stand there and wait."
William could see a second silhouette farther back on the launch, appearing and then vanishing in the fog. He slipped one hand into the pocket of his Chesterfield and felt for his revolver. Then the launch was in the clear, and slowing, and turning lengthwise to come up alongside them, and William could see the deck clearly. Two men, one in the wheelhouse, and the man in white was not Shade. Stout, his whiskers wild and leonine, and crowning his red face like a banker's, one hand held up in greeting. It was Gabriel Utterson.
"Mr. Pinkerton," Farquhar murmured. "That is the man's proxy, yes?"
He glowered.
"Mr. Pinkerton."
He shook himself, glanced away.
"That's his solicitor, yes."
Farquhar studied William's face with an anxious expression.
"You were expecting some other? Is anything the matter?"
William watched the urchin swipe her red cap from her head,
stuff it inside her coat. She scrambled over the railing and perched above the freezing waters as the launch neared. He took his hand off the revolver in his pocket. He had been naive, thinking shade would appear. "It's fine," he muttered. "Let's get this over with." Gabriel Utterson hailed them from the railing of the launch. His captain had tamped the boiler and the vessel had slowed and drifted sideways, and then come in close.
"I trust you have not come empty-handed, gentlemen,"
Utterson shouted across. William held the satchel high. Utterson nodded.
"I'll examine the contents, please," he called.
William gave the satchel to the urchin on the outside of the railing, and she turned, swinging it in one hand, and took two swift steps and leaped across the gap. The boats rocked and shifted and drew apart and drew close. William casually withdrew his revolver.
"Where is the painting?"
Farquhar hissed at him.
"I do not see it, sir."
"Patience, Mr. Farquhar.
What if it is a trick?"
William gave the gallerist a grim look. "In my experience," he said, "crooks are usually the least dishonest of the bunch. It's not in their interest to deceive you, sir. This is how they make their living. Be patient." Farquhar gave an uneasy glance at the fog creeping in and blowing past. A collier slid wraith-like through the mist. Utterson kneeled in the folds of his heavy coat, and he took off his gloves and unbuckled the satchel. No one spoke. The decks rolled gently in the current. At last the man rose, one knee at a time, with a stiffness, and he grimaced to Molly and buckled the satchel tight. The launch powered up, and a cloud of white steam belched from its stack, and Farquhar sucked in his breath.
"Easy," William said.
And then the launch drew in close, and Utterson clambered over the railing and leaned one tentative foot out and hooked himself onto the steamer's deck. William stepped forward, clasped his hand, hauled the stout solicitor across the gap.
"Dear God,"
he gasped,
"a damned foolish location for a business meeting."
He smoothed his collar, the thick sleeves of his greatcoat.
"Mr. Pinkerton, sir, I was not informed you would be present, and this must be Mr. Farquhar. A pleasure, sir, even under such circumstances."
"Such circumstances, sir,"
Farquhar said coldly,
"are of your own devising."
Utterson held a hand to his heart.
"Please do not imagine I condone this sort of behaviour. I act to ensure everyone's honest compliance, sir. I take no side in the matter, I assure you, and I have no vested interest in its outcome."
"Except if we get crossed," said William.
"Sir?"
"If that girl disappears with the money, you'll be held responsible."
"Oh."
Utterson smiled tightly.
"By whom, I wonder?"
"By me."
Farquhar ran a gloved finger under his chin.
"Mr. Utterson, I am not accustomed to waiting. My painting?"
"Shortly, sir. Shortly."
Utterson turned and gave a stiff wave, and the urchin cried some word to the captain, and the launch began to pull away into the mist.
"She is leaving with the bonds, Mr. Pinkerton,"
Farquhar barked sharply. He strode to the railing, gripped it fiercely. William set his hand on the gallerist's elbow.
"Patience," he said. "She'll be back. They won't have come to the meeting with the painting. They're not so trusting as that."
"But we are expected to be?"
William shrugged. 10 minutes passed. 20. At 30 minutes, Farquhar started to pace the deck in a temper. At the turning of the first hour, he ceased pacing and settled himself under the stacks, where the heat of the engine could be felt. The river grew colder. They waited in silence, and William began to fear he had been misled. But when he studied Utterson's expression, it seemed bored, unconcerned. At last, through the mist, they heard the launch approaching, and then it came into view. The urchin was standing at the bow, clutching a long painter's tube in one elbow, the strap looped at her wrist.
"Your painting, sir?"
Utterson said wearily. They were all three cold. As the launch drew up alongside, the urchin leaned back and pitched the tube overhand across the water, and Utterson caught at it and dropped it, and it clattered, rolling on the deck, and banged up against the wheelhouse. Farquhar seized it up in a panic.
"My God," he swore. "What is wrong with that creature?"
Utterson glared across at the urchin.
"I couldn't say, sir.
a most foolish display. The steamer was drifting lazily to port. Their captain stood at his wheelhouse, arms folded, silk hat rakishly atilt, smoking quietly. William could hear the low, distant thrum of river traffic in the fog. Farquhar had already unstoppered the tube and drawn the oilcloth bundle carefully clear and cracked open the roll. He unrolled only as much as the top edge of the painting, and he ran a soft finger along the cracks.
"Well, sir?"
Utterson stood over the gallerist, rubbing his hands for heat.
"Are you satisfied? Can we get off this blasted river?"
The gallerist met William's eye.
"It is the Emma, Mr. Pinkerton. I can't know the condition until we return to a proper location, but it is she."
"It will prove undamaged, sir. I am certain of it."
Farquhar was cautiously rolling the oilskin tight and sliding it all back into the leather painter's tube.
"Who are these men?"
he said with a sudden, fierce dignity.
"Mr. Utterson, you keep very poor company, sir. I should be ashamed."
But Utterson only shrugged, unoffended.
"I serve the interests of the law, sir. That is all."
William turned in time to see the girl's launch pull away and gather speed and disappear upriver into the mist. He stood, brooding, and then he strode sharply past the two men and leaned in at the wheelhouse and told the captain to follow the launch. The captain took the pipe in his fist, looked at him.
"Follow it? And the river in traffic?"
he said dubiously.
"I were paid to deliver you down current."
He had the powerful forearms of a sailor and the thick, tattooed neck of a pugilist, but William stood half again his weight, and he wrapped a hand over the captain's lapels.
"Follow that boat," he said again. "This is police business."
"He ain't police."
But there was uncertainty in the man's eye.
"Mr. Pinkerton,"
Utterson called sharply,
"I must advise against whatever it is you are intending. My clients were forthright and direct with you. You would do well to respect that. Captain, please proceed with your instructions."
The captain was looking angrily at William. William withdrew his coat from his pocket and cocked the hammer and pressed it against the captain's forehead. No one spoke.
"Aye,"
said the captain, very still.
"We'll follow her."
William uncocked the hammer and lowered the weapon. The captain stamped twice on the trapdoor of the boiler, and the steamer lurched and started to catch speed, and the deck rolled and rose, cresting, and fell in the spray. The launch was gone in the fog and the river traffic, and William did not know if it could be overtaken. They were moving at speed, and the hull smacked and jounced over the chop. He did not see the green hull of the launch. The wind was bitingly cold, and William felt the wings of his Chesterfield crackling out behind him, and he leaned into the rise and drop of the planks under him to hold his balance. Out of the corner of one eye, he glimpsed Utterson, shifting his weight, starting to approach, and William half-turned and raised his revolver. He could see Farquhar's face in the lee of the stack, lean, grey. Eyes closed, the painting in its tube crushed to his chest.
"You stay back,"
William hollered, the wind sucking the words from his lips. Utterson froze, tried to raise his hands on the rolling deck.
"What is it you mean to do, sir?"
William did not reply, but turned back, staring into the fog at the passing vessels. Colliers, with men clambering over their piles, ferries crammed with clerks, scows stacked with crates, one hand fixed to the railing to steady himself. And then the captain slowed and pointed, and William glimpsed the small green stern of the launch ahead.
"Don't overtake them," he called. "Keep us a distance back."
The urchin's launch drew in close to a rickety pier on the north bank below London Bridge, and William watched her leap nimbly ashore before the vessel had even moored, and then she was gone under the span in the crowds. He walked slowly the length of the deck and gripped the cables, staring all the while at the space where she had vanished, and as they drew near, he looped a leg over the railing. He'd be damned if he would let her escape. She was his one lead to shade.
"Mr. Pinkerton, sir,"
Farquhar called. He got unsteadily to his feet.
"You cannot mean to leave me here, sir. I hired you to ensure the safe return of the Emma."
"You have your painting."
"It has not yet been returned, sir. Not to safety."
"It's safe enough."
William paused, glared at the solicitor.
Mr. Utterson here has been hired to facilitate the exchange. It is in his interest to make sure no harm comes to you or to the painting. It is his reputation at stake here."
The captain's face lifted from behind his wheel.
"The Emma," he said.
"That ain't that painting what was stolen and in all the dailies now, is it?"
William frowned.
"Mr. Blackwell will be along shortly, I don't doubt," he said. "Make your own way or wait for his arrival, Mr. Farquhar. Either should suffice." He gave Utterson a black look. "I'll hold you responsible, sir, should any misfortune befall this gentleman." "Captain," he called. The burly man peered at him. William tipped his hat. "Thank you, sir." And then the peer was within reach, and he hurled himself across the closing gap, and rolled to his feet, and snatched up his hat, and pressed through the crowds after the girl. 47. Fool had stood silhouetted, high in the cold of the stone overpass, watching Farquhar and Pinkerton climb down from their brougham into the crowd. He wore a frayed wool labourer's suit, and he stood with his weight twisted over one leg, like a man arthritic and long worn down by the world, and he let the minutes pass. The itch and curl of the plaster worried away at the skin under his collar, and he raised two ruined fingers, smoothed the beard glued to his chin. Though he would be visible against the sky should Pinkerton look his way, the detective did not lift his face. He watched Molly approach, and then she was leading them down towards Billingsgate stairs, and Fool turned and walked briskly back across the span. Flood was waiting in a stained apron, running a hand over the mare's flanks, murmuring. They were reined up in a filthy court, and neither spoke, but instead climbed aboard the bench seat, and Flood clicked the reins, and the wagon creaked slowly out into the morning traffic.
"The clock," Flood grunted.
"Past 11. Gives us an hour in the clear."
"You seen to the butler, then?"
"Called away this morning on sudden family business. A sister facing imminent eviction." Flood smiled.
"Nice. And the cook? Them two cleaning girls?"
"Gone to the country with the mistress." Flood cracked the reins in impatience, and the mare lurched and leaned into her harness, the peeling slat boards of the wagon rattling as they went. The going was slow, and they did not reach Farquhar's residence until 11:30 the hour, and Flood was careful to pull sidelong to the bollards out front. On the gate of the wagon was painted Abbott's Carting and Movers in bold red letters. From the back, Flood lifted out an enormous wood crate, empty, Fragile stamped on the side. Fool took up several empty dun sacks. He pushed his cap back on his head, squinched up one eye.
"All righty," he said in a rough accent. "Let's get this here delivery done, eh, you moke?"
Flood grunted in disgust.
"Oi, you don't like me accent?" "Is that what that is?"
Fool grinned. The morning was bright, clear. There were ladies walking the footway escorted by men in silk hats, and Fool and Flood tipped their caps as they passed. They walked boldly up to the tall front doors and set down their loads, and Fool withdrew the forged keys on their ring and calmly tried each in the lock until the fourth took, and he turned it twice, and then the heavy oak doors to George Farquhar's mansion swung open, and the two men glanced back once, picked up their empty crate and sacks, and walked in. The house was still. They knew what they hunted, but stood in the gloom, listening all the same. No footfall, no movement. Fool had explained the floor plans to Flood as he had traced them on the night of the dinner, and the two men moved now as one, sliding silently towards the staircase. Farquhar would be somewhere down the Thames by now, Fool knew, Pinkerton with him. At the base of the stairs they parted. Flood went ahead into the depths of the house with his empty crate held out before him in search of silver plate and valuables from the dining room. Fool ascended the stairs. He went at once to the gentleman's bedroom and opened the drawers, and riffled through and scooped out the man's cufflinks, and examined each in the weak light, and placed them one by one into a sack. Farquhar had a fine collection of gold and silver pocket watches, and Fool took these as well. He found a small safe in the man's wardrobe, and he tried the various keys until he found the right one, and inside he discovered a large amount of cash and securities. He took all of it. He was quick, silent, to the point.
There were packets of private correspondence, and these he did not disturb. He paused in the upper hall, and admired the small watercolour of the Thames, and considered removing it from its bracket, but then thought otherwise. He passed on into the man's study, and there he searched the man's desk, but he did not find the letter he had left. He checked the pockets of the man's several coats, but it was gone. He frowned. He stood with a hand on his head and turned slowly. Out of pique, he took a gold-plated writing set, and a fine crystal paperweight, and a rare early copy of Shakespeare from the 17th century, and then he slipped back out into the hall. 11 minutes had passed. Inside Farquhar's wife's bedchamber, he paused, hand still on the door, feeling all at once uneasy. The room was dim, heavily furnished, a great oak four-poster with its drapes drawn looming in the center of the carpet. He did not know why the curtains of an unoccupied bed would be drawn, but the feeling passed, and the room still stood silent, and he went in and crossed to the far wall, and started going through the bureau. It was then he heard it, a soft sigh, a creak of the mattress. A grey hand parted the curtains of the bed, and the slow, sleep-rumpled figure of Mrs. Farquhar emerged. Fool froze. He melted back into the shadows, dark, wrathful. Her grey hair looked wild, her cheeks smudged with the night's makeup. She turned her face, coughed sharply, spat some substance into the carpet at her feet, then sat, rolling her shoulders, opening and closing her mouth. Fool did not dare breathe. But she did not look his way. After a moment, she groaned and eased her feet into a pair of velvet slippers and got up and picked a robe from her bedside chair and went out. Fool stood in the suddenly empty bedchamber, shaking in disbelief and clutching his half-filled sacks, and then he followed her to the door. She was descending the stairs, old, stiff, miserable. He thought of Flood below, filling his crate, and he thought to follow and warn him, but then changed his mind and slipped back into the old woman's bedchamber. The giant had a gift for such work, and would handle himself. Fool found nothing of value in the bureau, and he glanced anxiously at the door, but heard nothing. And then he opened an ancient, creaking wardrobe, and there it was, a second safe. The same key opened it as had opened her husband's, and Fool shook his head, amazed. Inside were two shelves, each filled with large jewelry boxes, heavy, and Fool opened the lid of the first, and for a sudden, impossible moment, crouched there, dazzled. 9, 10, 12 necklaces, cut diamonds of every carat, shining with a luminescence that burned up out of the stones themselves and filled the room with light. The pieces were exquisite. He shut the lid, shut the safe, shut the wardrobe, hurried out into the hall. The old lady still had not returned. He moved cautiously to the landing in the dimness. He did not know if Flood had found her yet, and he leaned out over the railing, and there he saw, in the gloom, the huge, silent figure of Flood, with his back pressed to a pillar in the great hall, wary. He could just make out the old lady in her pale robe emerging from the back hall, with an enameled tray in her hands, a pitcher of water, and a plate of cold chicken on the tray. And he watched the woman approach. She would need to turn at the pillar, and would pass the giant where he hid, and Fool tried to catch his companion's eye to warn him, but could not. The old lady came nearer. Fool feared what Flood must do, should she find him, and he had just set his sacks down and readied himself to leap the railing, when Flood, liquid, noiseless, poured around the pillar at the very moment she turned, keeping himself concealed, a shadow, a wraith, and the old lady glided unaware past. Then she was ascending the stairs, and Fool hid behind a potted fern, and watched her go back to her bedchamber, and he lifted the sacks silently into his arms to keep them from tinkling, and slipped noiselessly, step by step, down the carpeted stairs. Flood was waiting with a full crate in his arms, and he gave Fool a long, angry glower, and then the two thieves slipped outside, into the frenzy of the noon street, simple labourers, one a feeble-minded giant in an apron, the other an old man, worn by the world, eager to be gone. 48. William came at a run up the crooked stairs from London Bridge Pier, the nailed wood slats rattling under his weight, the clerks and passengers roughed up against the railing as he went. He did not see the girl. She had conducted herself with great coolness and professionalism that morning, and he understood, whatever else, that she was no hired amateur in this, but some valued part of Shade's crew. He pushed across to an iron gas lamp on a stone pedestal and half-climbed its length and scanned the roar of bridge traffic pouring north into King William Street, but she had vanished into the mist, his last trace back to Shade. A crossing sweep chuckled at him, face blacked, shoeless in the cold.
"Fine day for it, sir,"
he grinned. William looked at him, looked away, and there, out across the span of the bridge, he saw the girl. Crossing over into Southwark, red hat doffed, small shoulders hunched, she walked fast, ducking around the crush of carts, the leather satchel gripped tight. He dropped back to the ground and started to run. He would slow every 20 paces and hoist himself up onto the railing of the bridge and find her again. At last he had caught up to her, and he kept himself some 30 feet back, just at the edge of the drifting fog, and he followed her down off London Bridge and into the industrial chaos of Borough High Street. The traffic was rougher there, the men all in leather aprons or stained woolens. The girl glanced back the way she had come, then ducked into a small sweet shop. William drew his hat low, waited in a doorway across the street. After 10 minutes, a man in an ill-fitting coat came out wiping his hands on his trousers, and made his way down the block to a cab stand, and unhooked the nose bag from his mare, and climbed up into the driver's perch of his carriage. Then the girl came out. She kept her head low, with her cap obscuring her eyes, and went straight to the carriage and climbed in. William understood too late what was happening, and he swore, and started across the street at a run. But the carriage was already pulling out, and he reached the cab stand out of breath, and set a hand on the first hansom in line, and called out for the driver.
"Aye, sir, and where is it you're bound to, then?"
A young man slid lazily out from under a shelter. He was eating an apple. William gestured at the carriage disappearing in the traffic.
"I need to follow that carriage. You can manage that?"
The driver peered after the carriage.
"What? That four-wheeler there?
Aye, I'd say so,"
he said, cocking his hat back on his head.
"Be a shilling or two extra for the trouble, though. Don't lose it, and I'll pay you double."
"Double it is, sir. Up you get."
William hauled himself forcefully up, and the driver hooked a foot on the stem pole and scrambled onto his perch, and the hansom took off at a wild, jouncing pace. William gripped the leather handle and leaned forward, lowering at the shapes in the fog. He was thinking of his father's Shade. In that Cumberland photograph, he had seen no indication of love, nothing fierce nor unyielding nor to be dreaded. Still, he felt a rage rising in him, and he sat with his fists bunched before him as the cab rattled sharply on. The girl's carriage halted at a small public square at the junction of Newington Butts. Unwashed children lurked on the steps, and a knife-grinder's cart stood forlorn at an open gate. William's cab clattered past and reined up some 20 feet beyond at a wholesale grocer's yard off Kennington Park Road. He swung down with the air cold on his face, and he crushed a 5-pound note into the driver's hand.
"It's too much, sir,"
the man called in astonishment. But William was already striding away. The girl herself did not slow, but turned purposefully at Penton Place. It was a shabby terrace in that South London district, with houses set hard up against the footways, and a roadway filled with mud, as if it had once been set, and then the stones taken up again. He passed maids in heavy coats, and delivery men coaxing their wagons along the ruts, and junk men hauling their carts by hand. A stink hung in the air from the sperm oil works nearby, and he could not get the taste of it from his nostrils. His Colt Navy swung in his pocket, heavy as a stone in a stocking, and he set one hand on it to check its swing. Something about the street felt wrong. At last the girl turned and entered a house on the left. A strangled flower bed lay walled in and dying under the front steps, and there were rusting hinges where a gate must once have hung. On either side stood the melancholy, darkened houses of the dispossessed.